I've always wondered how foreign correspondents see this vast country, what it's like to come from abroad and cover this loony bin. We're talking during the crisis over the prisoner photos in Iraq, and just wondering how the reaction to that strikes you, how Americans think of their role in the world. We, you know, we're the perpetual innocents. Mm-hmm. We always mean good, and just a couple of bad apples, and people don't understand how good-hearted we are. Yeah. How does this all strike you, coming from the previous empire?
Well, I mean, that's it. There is a kind of there is a familiarity coming from Britain to America in terms of that you're really going backwards through history from the last empire to the big imperial nation to the present one, and that. In the same way that Britain always thought that it was a civilizing influence on the world, that it was always doing the right thing. So there is this sense in America, I think, with these pictures from Abu Ghraib. On the one hand, Americans are just like anybody else. They're not particularly exceptional in so far as they see those pictures and they are disgusted. But then it's what they do with that disgust. And then to all too many Americans, what happened is an aberration. As they're amazed that these things can happen under their flag. It seems like a distortion from everything else. And so there is this debate, which is only going on in America, as far as I can work out, about how we're going to win over Arab hearts and minds, as though bombing Fallujah was winning over Arab hearts and minds, and now these awful pictures have come out. It's so terrible. And with the administration, you really get a sense, a bit like Rodney King, that the problem is not that they did it for them, the problem is that they were caught, and that they were caught in a way that was so irrefutable that they are that they can't deny it, and so they wrap it up. They have to kind of they have to dump on someone, so they dump on the people at the bottom of the pile, in this case the soldiers who perpetrated the abuses, and hope that it doesn't filter out. All of this actually very familiar to any Brit who's looked at the way that Britain deals with Northern Ireland. Actually,
Britain, of course, is the junior partner in this adventure, and how does this sort of thing play in Britain? Or, of course, British soldiers have been implicated in it as well. So what's the reaction from the British audience, and what are your editors in Britain interested in having you cover here?
Well, I mean, in terms of the reaction to... There is a peculiar desire, oftentimes, in Britain to, in the last couple of years, to offload all responsibility onto America. So it's not just these soldiers who are following orders, but the Brits were following orders too. You know, like our whole nation was following this order from our senior partner in crime to go and bomb these people, and we had no choice. And in that sense, there is an element of the British left that really kind of can annoy me when they blame Bush without thinking, well, actually, what are we doing in Britain? We actually have a government in Britain that, not that Bush isn't blameworthy, but we've got to let the Americans deal with Bush. We've got our own mini-me Bush in Tony Blair, and actually worse than Bush, most lefties voted for him. I mean, he's a Labour Prime Minister. He's not from the right. He's a creature that we made. And there's a desire to abrogate our responsibility in this as a country that elected a government that has gone along with and gone ahead with this, and that we have an internal domestic responsibility to get rid of Blair. Actually, in many, many ways, I find the British situation more depressing, because at least you have, when you go to the polls in America, you will have some semblance of an alternative in Kerry or Nader. This doesn't mean that they will necessarily do a whole lot that is different, but it's
this,
not like...
This may surprise some of our audience who would think that there's virtually no difference. So you're saying that there's actually more of an alternative here than in Britain?
At the moment, yes, because we have... In Britain, it's Kerry doing this. It's the equivalent of Kerry doing this. So unless you're going to go out and vote for Bush, or the equivalent of Bush, the Conservative Party, then this is at least a... this is a creature that we have created. I'm not saying that the choices in America are vast or great or wonderful or whatever, but the fact of having a right-wing person who's doing this has given large numbers of people a focus for the discontent, which is getting rid of Bush. Even just hating Bush is a kind of focus for your discontent. But if the focus for your discontent is the guy that you elected, well, that's a different problem.
You alluded to a certain blame America reflex in the British left. Also, I guess it would include a lot of the European left as well, continental European left as well. That somehow America is the guilty party and they're all innocent. How do you feel about that?
My parents came from Barbados, and my parents came from the former empire to Britain. And so, as someone who's seen the French, who's seen Jacques Chirac in action against Muslims, who's seen all different colours of European nastiness, I feel that there is a selective amnesia in Europe, that for most of the world the distinction between America and Europe is minimal. I mean, there has been a continuum whereby we've gone from colonialism, French, British, Portuguese, whatever, to US imperialism. But it's not like these people are thinking, damn, these Americans are really awful, I wish we had the French back. You know, it's not like the Haitians are begging to have the French back. And so there's a desire to forget what most of the world remembers, which is that Europe has done very similar things, and that coming from Britain, one of the better examples is Northern Ireland. That there's very little that you can say about the war on terror that America has done that you couldn't say that happened in Britain over Ireland. Our press was craven and spineless. The spectrum of debate was minimal. Our civil rights were trampled on. People were lied to. Atrocities took place. And all of that happened under the British flag, and the British people didn't do a thing about it. So when I hear people talking about America as though it's exceptional, I think the one thing that makes America exceptional is that it's exceptionally powerful. When Britain or France or Germany has been powerful, they have done very, very similar things. So it's about power and the misuse of power. It's not about America. The other thing that I think large numbers of people in the West don't seem to understand, in Europe particularly, don't seem to understand, are the huge numbers of Americans who oppose this. Now, this isn't entirely their fault. Some of it is a superior attitude that somehow they're more liberal than everybody else. But some of it is because the mass opposition that there is in America, I don't know that it's a majority, but I know that it's huge, has not percolated through the political system to a place where it would be given voice, where British people would see or hear it, and that's a shame.
Were you surprised when you arrived here by the diversity of opinion in the country? Did it seem more monolithic from a distance and less so when you got up close?
I was surprised by the level of nuance, by how shaded the issue. And I'm still surprised by, the Americans do make a distinction. If you look at Bush's ratings on how he's fighting terror, they're quite high. If you look at them on how he's doing in Iraq, they're pretty low. That in all sorts of ways, Americans are making distinctions. What I think I wasn't prepared for is the gulf between, there are many Americas, but at the moment between these two Americas, some call them red and blue, the coasts and the heartland, whatever you want, that if you go from New York City to Spartanburg, South Carolina, you go to a different country. You go to a country where religion is key, where the apocalypse is real, where people read different books, where people in all sorts of ways have a completely different set of reference points, which I think that Spartanburg, South Carolina, or Ruleville, Mississippi, or Nacogdoches in Texas are as foreign to New York as, or more foreign to New York than London is, actually. And I think the same would be true if you went the other way to LA or even to Chicago. That I wasn't prepared, that even to talk about America at this stage as though it's one country is to paper over a huge crack which is becoming a kind of fault line, really.
What about the domestic repression here? Like a lot of dissidents have been stunned by the kinds of moves the Bush administration has taken to crack down on dissent and the kinds of detention without trial or even charges. Does this seem familiar to you from the British experience in Northern Ireland, or is this a different degree?
Without wanting to outdo America in terms of, we've got a much more repressive system, or we have had, in some ways I think is less than we had in Northern Ireland. At one stage in Northern Ireland, we had a situation where elected MPs, Sinn Féin, the political wing of the IRA, had MPs like Gerry Adams, that elected MPs, you were not allowed to hear their voice spoken on television. This is a broadcasting ban which lasted for several years. Instead, you could see them on television and you could see their lips moving, but they weren't allowed to broadcast their voice because they said it would the oxygen of publicity, we must cut off the oxygen of publicity to terrorists. So instead, what BBC and other organisations did was have an actor read their words in sync with their lips moving. So for the longest time, I never knew what Gerry Adams sounded like, even though he was an MP in the British Parliament, because we weren't actually allowed to hear his voice. His voice was banned. So there are differences. The key difference, I think, between Britain and America in this is that you have a constitution. We don't. And so all sorts of violations can take place to which there's no reference point. That said, I've been surprised by how readily many Americans have been prepared to give up some of these rights. Even though there is a large amount of opposition to it, how quickly and readily people were to say, oh, okay, so no right to appeal. And this, I think, is because they regard the terrorist as other. So there is a sense in all of this that this is not going to happen to me or my family because we're decent and fair and reasonable, but, you know, we do have to stop terrorists and anything goes. And it's no surprise to me that most of the Patriot Act, they try to rush in immediately after September 11th. So it's kind of, you know, in terms of it being a country fueled by fear and what fear will do, that has been intriguing and somewhat surprising.
Some of us look enviously at the state of the British media, more seriousness, more political diversity, and just a little more substance. Is that fair, and how do the American media strike you?
There are some kind of market reasons for that Britain is a relatively small country. I mean, it'd be like the 12th largest state in America, if that. And so you have a number of papers, newspapers, competing on a national level, and they compete ideologically. So there is a high Tory paper, The Telegraph, then there is the establishment paper, The Times, then there's a centrist paper, The Independent, and then there's the left liberal paper, The Guardian. Also true of the tabloids. We have The Mirror, which is has actually moved rapidly to the left as a tabloid, and pictures of Blair with blood on his hands, and has had John Pilger as a columnist, and then you have The Sun, which is a Murdoch paper and rabidly right wing. So, and that's true for much of Europe, that papers are they have ideological constituencies, whereas in America most of the constituencies for newspapers are geographical. If you're in Washington, you read The Post. If you're in Milwaukee, you meet the Sentinel. If you're in LA, you read the LA Times. Where it really stands out is Israel. It's very rare that you see in the American media intelligent criticism of Israel beyond the very, very mild. Oh, they've gone and killed some people again. What a shame. You know, no kind of interrogation of what that might be about in a way that you would in Britain, and that you would, you know, and The Guardian will have Palestinian writers, you know, and then otherwise I would say, just generally on the war on terror and Iraq and things like that, that's where that diversity, you know, really, really shows itself. So to that extent, it is deserved. We also have a state broadcaster, and that makes a difference, you know, that we don't, in the BBC. And so,
we have Fox News,
which is also your state broadcaster. That is true. I mean, with this Abu Ghraib thing, that also shocked me that CBS would sit on that story for 2 weeks because the head of the army told them to, or asked them to, and he asked them to because, you know, it was going to be more tricky to kill people in Fallujah if these things came out. I don't think that would happen in Britain.
Even with the state broadcaster?
Yeah, even with the state broadcaster. Actually, especially with the state broadcaster, because they, you know, they really police that difference strongly. Having said that, possibly Northern Ireland would have been an example where, you know, where that would have happened. But there are big differences. But the biggest difference, I think, is that we weren't attacked on September 11th. And after September 11th, Britain wasn't the primary prosecutor of these wars. And so in exactly the same way that you could read the New York Times, the Boston Globe, the LA Times were much, much better on Northern Ireland than Britain, British newspapers ever were, because they weren't coming from a culture that felt hysterical and that was fueled by fear. That gave them the space to actually do their job and do much more critical reporting.
What about the fetish of objectivity that American journalists like to hold themselves to? Do you think this is... what do you think about it? Do you think there's anything to it, or is it a cover for some kind of bias?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's ridiculous. I think they're kind of... they worship of this abstract notion of that in some way they're kind of fair and reasonable and, you know, or fair and balanced. Is that what Fox News calls themselves?
Yeah,
I think it's utterly laughable, and this war has shown it to be laughable, that kind of, were the American press objective, they would have been more critical about the WMD claims. I don't think that anybody knew whether there were weapons of mass destruction there or not, but the case that the administration made was not sufficiently well scrutinized. It was swallowed up and eaten whole. And for me, the way that the American press in a run-up to the war reported what was going on in the administration was far more scandalous than anything Jason Blair ever did. Jason Blair's reportorial kind of mistakes were a big problem, but they didn't kill anyone. So I found that entire episode really very, very peculiar. That I don't think you could have gotten a resignation from anyone over their reporting of the war.
Judith Miller still has a job.
For example.
Well, let's talk a bit about one of the central issues of American life for practically our whole existence as a nation, race. You've just returned from a trip to Milwaukee. Why Milwaukee, and tell us what you found.
Milwaukee is the, according to a census survey, the most segregated city in the country. And I went there for... The Guardian, to do a piece for the 50th anniversary of Brown versus Board of Education, and just to try and look at how segregation is lived in America. It's always fascinated me as a black British person. I'm married to an African-American woman from Chicago. The way that race is understood here is so completely different to... completely different to the way in which race is lived and understood in Britain. Not better, not worse, just different. And I wanted to get the 50th anniversary of Brown gave me an opportunity to just kind of look at that in, just in terms of segregation. And I mean, what you found, or what I found was, on the one hand, a lot of white people in denial. There's just been a mayoral race in Milwaukee that was split entirely, almost entirely down racial lines. The black candidate lost. Blacks and Hispanics voted for one, whites voted for another one. If you spoke to African Americans in Milwaukee, they said, this did not surprise us. The prospect of a black person getting their hands on those resources was more than many white people could bear. If you spoke to many white people, including liberals in Milwaukee, they told you, this had nothing to do with race. You know, this is all about who was kind of best person for the job. And the black candidate did have some kind of financial... There was a kind of financial irregularity issue, but it was a bookkeeping issue, really. And they say that, you know, that was what happened. And the fact that you have that gulf of perception is the segregation kind of, you know, there it is in a conversation. But also just the way that people... I think this is not particular to Milwaukee. It becomes... it's almost second nature in any American city. I mean, it's just what it is, you know, to many people. Any American city that I've been to, there's a black part of town. And that no one is, and by definition then, there's a white part of town. And no one is embarrassed about that. Nobody minds. Nobody kind of questions, you know, well, where did that come from, or why would that be? I have a problem with people who self-identify. I don't have a problem with, you know, black people who want to be around other black people, or white people who want to be around other white people, depending on why they want to do it. You know, I think that kind of that there's a place for that, but it demands interrogation at each stage. Well, you know, well, why? You know, what are you going to get out of this? You just didn't see a lot of that. It was just kind of, well, you know, this is the way it is. And you reach, there's a street, it's Third Street, I think. They call it Old World Street. At Walnut, Old World Street, where Walnut meets Old World Street, it becomes Martin Luther King Drive. And then three blocks up, by that stage, all the white people have disappeared. And that becomes your kind of daily life, you know. And there's a way in which I kind of find that soul-destroying. Because it's not like the black areas and the white areas are the same. The white areas are always really wealthy, and the black areas are always really poor. And so, often, you will see a black area before you even see black people, because you think, wow, this looks like a, kind of, not a rough neighborhood, but a bit down a hill, and it doesn't look like there's been a whole lot of investment there. And then, you know, ping, you know, you find that you left the white part of town.
Just like the sun rises in the east to America, right?
Well, how is this different from Britain?
Britain is first of all smaller. We have a different racial history. Britain exported segregation, but it didn't bring it back home. So we exported it, you know, we exported slavery to America. My parents, you know, grew up in Barbados, in India, in Ghana, in all those places that, you know, there was codified separation of the races. So that's one way. In Britain, in the British Isles, we never kind of had those, we never had those laws. We had those practices, but not those laws. Then the manner in which black people came to Britain was different. That black people had been in Britain since the Roman times, but in large numbers came shortly after the war. So our parents were immigrants, and they came from the former colonies. You know, when our Britishness would be challenged in Britain, we'd say, "Well, we're here because you were there." Part of that job, but part of the task in terms of race thinking in Britain is educating white people about what they did abroad, you know, because, for example, you go to the pretty much anywhere in America, whatever kind of craziness white people might come up with, no one's going to tell you that there wasn't slavery in America. No one's going to say that. No one's going to say there wasn't segregation. Whereas in Britain,
just so long ago, we don't have to think about it.
Yeah, right. I mean, there will be a dispute about its legacy, about its meaning, and so on. But there won't be a dispute about it actually existed. But in Britain, you have to kind of be constantly educating people, white people, about what went on, because it went on abroad. You know, that Britain had its civil rights movement abroad. That, you know, the Kwame Nkrumah. You know, all of the anti-colonial uprisings, Gandhi, it all happened abroad. And so white people in Britain did not have the opportunity, or they had to look much harder for the opportunity to be educated in issues of race than they did in America. It doesn't mean everybody's going to learn a lesson. It doesn't mean everyone's going to show up for class. But at least the class is there. You know, that if you were around in the 50s and 60s, you knew there was something happening, even if you didn't like it. In Britain, you could have been around 50s, 60s, 70s. You didn't know anything until the people turned up on your doorstep. So there was no education, no racial education for white Brits. Our parents came in large numbers. They came to do the jobs that white people wouldn't do after the war. So my mother was a nurse, bus drivers, train drivers, concentrated in certain areas and certain sectors. So they were all middle class. They were all working class, you know, mostly public sector working class, which means that because of the way class is configured in Britain, you don't get out of that very, you know, there is very little class mobility in Britain. And so we remain mostly, predominantly, a working class kind of community, whether we're black or Caribbean or African or Bangladeshi or Pakistani. And that means we have a very small, very, very small middle class. And in general, because Britain is a smaller country, we're just less, there's been less opportunity to segregate ourselves in any meaningful way. So mixed marriages are much more common. Black people more likely to rise through the trade union movement than through the army, as is, you know, as is the case here. In all sorts of ways, it would feel peculiar to be in an entirely black segregated place. White segregated places, 10% of Britain is not white, 90% is white, you know. So white segregated places happen all over the place, in parliament, and, you know, boardrooms, and, you know, in all sorts of ways. But we don't have the kind of cultural or social kind of history or equipment to develop black fraternities, sororities, universities, all the kind of things that African Americans have.
And finally, what kind of reaction do you get from Americans when they hear a black man speaking with a British accent?
Well, it depends where you are, and it depends who you talk to. White folks down south are the most interesting, because particularly if you go somewhere like South Carolina, where they really fetishize Englishness as being the height of culture, the height of the height of being refined and so on. And then this black guy with an earring shows up, and they want my accent, but they don't want anything else to do with me apart from that. And so it can be, you know, that can be peculiar. It can work that, and this was true. I went to this school in Mississippi, this is about 6 years ago, where everything was segregated. So there were still, not the classes, but there were two principals, two cheerleaders teams, all that kind of stuff. And I called the black principal, he wouldn't speak to me. I called the white principal, and it turned out the white principal had been to my hometown in England, God knows why, tiny town. So he was very excited. He said, come over, come over. So I came over, and then this white principal kind of takes a look at me, and he was mean, and he wasn't kind of, he was just, you know, in shock. So that turned out okay. And then he said, oh, we'll meet my black colleague. And I said, well, you know, I called him and he didn't want to speak to me, so I'll be okay. You know, I'll vouch for you. And then we go speak to his black colleague, and he takes me to the side afterwards, and he says, did you call me the other day? And I said, yeah, I did, but you didn't want to speak to me. And he said, sorry, I thought you were white. So it can work both ways. My favorite is a woman this was in Jackson, Mississippi, who found out that I spoke Russian. I studied Russian at university, and this came out somehow, and she got very excited. And she said, go on, lay some of that Russian on me now. I want to hear some of that Russian now. Go on, lay some of that Russian on me. And I said, what do you want me to say? And she called her friend over. She was like, damn, did you hear that? Damn. And it transpired, like I was wondering what the hell she was talking about. It transpired that she actually thought I was speaking Russian. When I said, what do you want me to say? She thought I'd just given her some Russian. So you can be that foreign. It's not peculiar for me, because I've always been black and always had this accent, but it can be very peculiar for them.
For a melting pot, we're very provincial sometimes. Thanks for joining us, Gary.